Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Ruth Garrett Millikan, Distinguished Professor Emerita at the University of Connecticut. Her new book, Beyond Concepts, UNICEP's Language and Natural Information, is just out from Oxford University Press. Kant famously asked the question, how is knowledge possible? In her new book, Millikan responds to this question from her characteristic naturalistic and specifically evolutionary perspective. Millikan has long been a leading figure in theorizing about language and thought. Her latest work considers the clumpy world that organisms confront and the problem of how we recognize the same objects and properties again, as well as their kinds and categories. Our cognizing machinery includes unitrackers, whose job it is to track these items and channel information of the same item to one place, which she calls a unicept. And while each of us has distinct unitrackers and unicepts, they can be attached to the same word in a public language, and words themselves are seen as lineages of reproduced signs. There's plenty to talk about in the book, and there's plenty we talked about in the interview. So let's turn to the interview. Hello, Ruth Millikan. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hello, Carrie. Nice to be here.
I'm very honored and pleased to be talking to you about your new book, Beyond Concepts. Before we get to the book itself, I thought, you know, because many of our listeners will be to some extent, you know, certainly familiar with who you are, to some extent also familiar with your work, at least in broad outline. We'd like to start with a question about, you know, you, the interviewee themselves about, you know, how they got to philosophy and how they came to write this book. And, you know, despite the fact that many people will be familiar with you and with your work, I think it would still be an interesting way to begin to get some idea of, you know, how you became attracted to philosophy and how you came to work on the particular topics that you have.
I guess I didn't even know there was such a thing as philosophy until I went to college. I went to Oberlin College, and there it was required. You had to have a course in philosophy. And luckily, I took it in my sophomore year, because then I could major in it. If I'd taken it later, I probably couldn't have changed. But it was the teacher I had, I think, who really brought me into philosophy. His name was Paul Schmidt. He was a Yale graduate. And he ran his classes completely by Socratic method, so that you were brought into thinking about problems, ancient problems and modern problems, immediately. And he always made you feel as though you actually might come up with the answer. Anyway, I was absolutely fascinated by the topics. I had never heard anybody talk about topics like that before. So I actually skipped the infirmary one, jumped out of the infirmary one day, snuck out when I was sick to go to his class. I was so fascinated. So So I majored in philosophy. But then I was a couple of years after, I was just doing various things. You should teach your little kids to play violin out in Berkeley and things like that, taking photographs. Anyway, my friend Ernie Hook, who's his father was Sidney Hook, or you might have heard of him. He's a very, very well-known political philosopher. Anyway, Ernie and I had taken logic together. We were the only two people that took symbolic together at Oberlin, and so we knew each other quite well, and he was out in Berkeley. And he just simply arrived at my house one day with his portable typewriter under his arm and an application blank for Yale, and he said, "You're going to apply to Yale Graduate School." So he wrote it all down, and I applied to Yale Graduate School, and so that's how I began.
And then you came to be writing about, you know, philosophy of mind. I mean, you changed the field in a way. I mean, in a fundamental way.
Well, when I was at Yale, I thought I was going to write a dissertation on what I called attitudes, on what attitudes are, which are, you know, be related, I suppose, to work people doing on emotions. And somehow or other, it turned out that I had to think about some more basic kind of epistemological problems before I could even think about that. So I've never got back to the thesis problem. I'm still trying to do the underpinnings. Right.
So, I mean, you mentioned in the book towards the beginning that, you know, the broad theme is this, the Kantian question of how knowledge is possible. And you approach it, you know, as many people, many listeners will know, from a naturalistic and specifically evolutionary perspective on how we, you know, obtain and store and generate knowledge, concepts, or in this case, unicepts. So we'll get into that in a second. But you start the book with a certain vision of, you know, what the world is like that we think about, that we may have knowledge about. And you describe it as a clumpy or messy world that presents the organism with, you know, with a lot of problem distinguishing, you know, which clumps kind of cohere, which are different clumps from other clumps, and which are the same clump over time and from different perspectives. So can you say something about the world that, as you see it, that the organism that wants to know the world, what that world is like, that they're confronting in terms of the clumps and then the categories and kinds that are out there as well?
Yeah, the thought is that if the world were not structured the way it is, we really couldn't have such a thing as thought. That thought is dependent upon the fact that the world organizes itself in a certain way. And the basic idea here is that the world organizes itself into clumps. We can think first of individuals. Clumps of individuals that are like one another in a whole lot of different ways, many of them, and some of them will not be, you know, they won't all have exactly the same characteristic, but so there won't be a definition for them, but they will have similar overlapping characteristics. And there will be a reason for this. This is very important, that there will be a reason for this. So a paradigm example would be a species. See, one dog is like another dog for a good reason, right? There are causal reasons that connecting one dog with another. Anyway, the fact that the world comes in clumps like this means that it's possible to use induction. So if you discover that there's a clump dog, then it becomes reasonable to suppose that a characteristic you see in one dog may well show up in another. So think, for instance, of a veterinarian where they're investigating something about dogs. They experiment on two or three dogs, and they figure that this might be true of all dogs. If it's so, we're constantly generalizing, really, from just a few examples, and the only way that we could do this is because the world comes in kind of clumps like that, and sort of spaces between these clumps. I mean, there isn't really anything. If you tried to sort of think of possible creatures running between dogs and cats, even, you wouldn't find any way to sort of make one just like the next, almost just like the next, almost just like the next, to get from cats to dogs, where there wouldn't be, as a matter of fact, you'd find there was nothing whatsoever somewhere in there. There'd be a big space somewhere in there. Things don't fade into each other. Except, of course, within clumps that do. I mean, there also are, you know, some of these clumps are pretty vague. You know, exactly what is going to count as a member of the clump is not clear. So my claim is that the thought is only possible because there are such clumps. We can latch onto them, and this is why inductions are possible. And that's why we can have knowledge.
Okay, so in traditional, there's a very helpful glossary, I should say, at the back of the book, which listeners can look at their leisure. But so the vocabulary that I use to ask questions will not necessarily be your vocabulary, but will
That's fine.
Traditionally we think about and this Kant as well, but we think of we have concepts or ideas, to use the empiricist term, and we get sensory input. We store and organize this information some way about the world in concepts or ideas. And that's all very, very, vague. But I mean, the vocabulary and some sort of mental entity of some sort is clearly what people are trying to capture there. You, however, you introduce, as the subtitle shows, the concept of a unicept, and then the associated concept of a unitracker. And since these two concepts are central to the book, maybe you can tell us a bit about unicepts and about unitrackers and how the unicepts are distinct from concepts, and that can get us started, I think.
I take it that the most fundamental job that cognition has for any animal, the most difficult job really, is to be able to recognize the same thing again through many, many, many different sensory inputs, right? I mean, a child learns to recognize a dog by its bark, by what it looks like from many angles, by what it feels like, and eventually you learn to recognize information about dogs by reading the word dog. But anyway, I take it that really a very, very fundamental thing that any animal has to do, any higher animal has to do, is to learn to recognize the same thing again. If you can't recognize the same thing about again, any knowledge you have of it is going to be useless, right? You can't apply it if you can't recognize the same thing again. So, all right, then the claim is also that, as I said, that the world comes in clumps. And so what one is really trying to do is to recognize these clumps. So that the dog is a clump, a bunch of animals that are pretty much like each other, maybe some at the fringes that are different in some basic ways, but a kind of a clump. You have to learn to recognize that, an instance of that clump, so that you can apply knowledge that you learned before of dogs. Of whatever, so this is true not just, of course, of things like species and kinds. That's also true of properties. Perceptual constancy is mechanisms are designed precisely to do this, to learn to recognize these are the same color under many different lighting conditions, the same shape under many different from many different perspectives, etc. Anyway, let's take this to be a very fundamental job. And what a unitracker, I take to be simply, you can think of it as a neural apparatus whose job is to learn over time to recognize the same thing again and to channel information that's gained about that thing into sort of one one place so that that those various pieces of information can interact with one another. So that everything you know about some substance will be in a form that you know that it's about the same thing and can use it as about the same thing. So if it has five characteristics, you know that they're all characteristics of the same thing, and you might be able to infer something from that, you see. So that's what a unit tracker is some kind of neural net, I suppose. Very complicated. A unicept then is simply what the unit tracker feeds into that manages in some way or another to store information that's been acquired by the unit tracker by tracking the same thing over time. So the unicept then is what basically figures in, say, a propositional knowledge about something, practical knowledge about something. So you can think of it as, it wouldn't hurt to think of it in terms of as initially at least, as a folder. People have been talking now since actually Strawson began this, really, about thinking of a folder in which you put information, which would be all the information about Johnny or all the information about dogs if you put in a folder. But I think that there's only one thing that's bad about that, and that is that on that model, things that you know about Johnny or about Fido, say that Fido is brown. If you've got brown in the Fido folder, and you've got brown also in the spotty in the Rover folder, the problem is that you have to somehow or other recognize that brown is the same, and the folder analogy won't give you that. So I'm thinking in terms of a much more intensive network, which, as a matter of fact, you know, the brain is an incredibly intensive network, in which also properties are recognized by an individual kind of place of storage, which is connected to all of the things that have that property, that one knows has that property in the brain. So, all right. So a unit tracker, then, is something I have. My unit tracker for dogs, you have yours. A unit tracker is an individual thing. It's not like a concept, because we share concepts. You don't share unit trackers. You've got yours for dog, and I've got mine. And we may have somewhat different ways of recognizing dogs. Vet can recognize dogs maybe in some ways that I can't. Helen Keller recognized dogs in a very different way, probably, from the way you and I do. But she certainly had a unicept for dogs and a unicept and a unitracker for dogs. But it was very, very different from the ones that you or I have. So the unitracker's individual. It's you have yours for a dog, and I have mine for dog. And what they have in common is that they both are focused on dogs. Right, that's out in the world. So it's their connections with the world that makes them alike, not necessarily anything that they have sort of psychologically in common, as it were. We may have quite different methods of doing the same thing here. So it's very unlike a concept in that regard. Also unlike concept in another way. I take it that different people will have different sets of ways of recognizing the same thing, and that there will be no way of recognizing that's definitional of dog. So you don't find out. I mean, the way in which words are connected to unicepts is that's another story. But what is not true? What is not true is that your idea of a dog is at, you know, you and I both think about dogs, that what we have in common is that we would identify the same thing as dogs, say in other possible worlds or et cetera, et cetera. So the method of recognition is not what defines what I'm thinking of. It's what I'm recognizing by that method that defines what I'm thinking of. So that's very, very different from thinking of a classical concept where usually you think of, you know, people talk about our concept of a universe, our concept of this, you know, there's no such thing as our concept of, right? No such thing as our unicept of. We all have different ones of the same things. So they're alike only in that they are of the same things. That, all right, does that help, Terry?
Yeah, no, so let me just, you know, since you mentioned, you know, word, I mean, one of the questions that comes up with a sort of a radically individualist, you might say, view, where unicepts are, you know, particulars.
They're individual people's property. Property
correct,
of individual people.
Correct, correct. Right. So then how, you know, the obvious question is, well, then how do we communicate, right? I mean, we're using this, you know, do we have, it's almost like, I was going to say we use the same word dog, but in fact, if my word dog or the form of words that I say, you express saying dog and the form of words that you use, I don't know, we're expressing two different unicepts. So how does communication happen with all these distinct unicepts? What grounds the common, you know, the idea at least that there is a common meaning to dog or something? Is it just the thing out there? But
the common meaning for dog is the dog. He's out there. And I have a way of recognizing him. And you have a way of recognizing him. And one of our ways of recognizing him, of recognizing information coming to our senses through dogs, you and me as English speakers, is the word dog. So that is actually like the smell of a dog, the look of a dog, the word for a dog. But of course, now we're in a whole different dimension. And that is, we're in the dimension of what information is, how language works, you know, so, which is more in the second half of the book. But yeah, I mean, what you have to do that too in order to carry out the project I'm trying to carry out. Yeah, it's complicated.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll get to the second, you know, so the first part is, you know, goes through unicepts and things like that. And we'll get to the more linguistic stuff a little later on. So let's just continue about this idea of, you know, the dog and then my unicept of it and yours. How do the unicepts get their reference? I mean, if I may use the word reference in that context.
Yeah, okay. So now we're going in another direction, also extremely important. All of my work has been sort of backed by evolutionary theory. And I wanted to say that what makes a thought, if you want to know what a thought is about, you've got to look at how it was designed. You have to look at its history, basically, what it was designed for. All right, so we have to look to what it was designed for in the case of a unicept, and in the case of a word is different dimension here, but yes, you have to look at what it was designed for in the case of a unicept. So what that means is we have to think about actually a development, uniceptual development, right? How do unicepts get formed? And so I have quite a lot to say about that, which I can't unpack here, but the idea is that the human is designed in order to learn to begin to recognize things in the world, to learn how to focus in on those things and to develop unicepts, to find the things in the world that can be recognized in many different ways and that have many different properties. In order to find those clumps, we have mechanisms that are built into us, which allow us to learn Kant. I'll learn Unicepts, that. And it's what makes the Unicept about it, about something, is exactly that it's been tuned by a mechanism that's designed exactly to tune it, to recognize and collect information about a certain thing and to use it. So it's a history, really. It's the method of the design of the Unicept, which is where you find out what it's really supposed to be. What is it supposed to be finding? What is it supposed to be re-identifying?
So let me just, these are so far, we're talking about, fairly ordinary, observational sorts of, or Unicepts that are the result of unitracking of more or less ordinary clumps in the world. But of course we go on far beyond that, right? So there's science and there's unobservables and things like that. How are the kinds of things, I guess, that ordinary people that, most of us, are fully equipped to track. How do those things relate to the sorts of things that scientists?
I take it that it's the development of good unit trackers sometimes can be very easy, sometimes very difficult. I mean, one thing we have to ask here is, how do you know that it's the same thing again that you are tracking? That you have tracked and put in and sort of stored with this Unicept. How do you know it's the same? And so I have to say something quite a lot about that. What kind of criteria, as it were, does the brain use or does the mind use in order to realize that it is in fact identifying correctly, re-identifying correctly? A very interesting one. That is for sophisticated humans, we're not going to find this in animals, is the use of the law of non-contradiction as a regulative principle. In other words, what you were trying to do, or what criterion of you're having a focused Unicept will be that information you find about it, the ways you have of identifying, you get some information today, it doesn't conflict with the information about the same thing tomorrow, that you got tomorrow. In other words, that you find yourself not contradicting yourself about this thing. All right, that's exactly. This generalizes to science. So I take it that the strongest evidence that a scientist has that he's talking about something real, that she's talking about something real, is exactly that. She has a number of different ways of identifying that thing. And when she does, she finds the same thing about it, the same things are true of it. So it's a matter of having, several different tracks, several different ways. So this would be the more in which that entity is caught up in a network of theories which allow us to recognize its presence or recognize its operation in a number of different contexts, that really is the basic criteria we have that the thing is real.
Okay, so let me just ask another sort of question. You know, one of your interlocutors over the year was Jerry Fodor, who recently passed. And one of the sort of brief comments that you make is that a language of thought, model or implementation model of Unicepts would not work. And I was just wondering if you might just say something about that to kind of flesh out the view a bit.
Yeah. Okay. A very central theme in the book, and actually in some of my previous work too, has been that the act of identifying, the act of recognizing a thing, is basically an act always of re-identifying. And there are a number of different ways that one could represent identity. And two of the most basic ways you could represent identity, one is the way language does, you say the word dog a second time, and supposedly it means the same thing. So the identity is found in the identity of kind, the identity of properties, as it were, of the word. So that's to represent identity by similarity of that sort is the way language works. So if I said John did this, and then a few minutes later I said John did that, you know it's the same things being talked about because I used the same. A duplicate. I used a duplicate of the word John in another sentence, right? All right, there's another way to recognize identity, or another way more fundamental, in fact, way to represent identity. And that's by using the very same individual thing again to represent. Now, I'll give you an example. You're making a map, and you have one little mark there that's for Pittsburgh. And you show the relation of Pittsburgh to Boston, to San Francisco, to Philadelphia, you know, all with the same dot. You don't duplicate. You don't say Pittsburgh is this and Pittsburgh is that and Pittsburgh is something else, like in language. Pittsburgh is that dot. And it's connected to all of those other things, but it itself is standing, you know, is standing. Now that's the kind of move that Strawson made, which has developed into the current talk about folders, as folders as being what concepts are. But I mean that's the important thing that Strawson did in his move was exactly to say, you know, sameness is recognized by identity, not by similarity. So I'm just pushing that further. I want to say that's the way identity is recognized, is by sameness, actual numerical identity. So I want to show that that's a fundamental way of recognizing identity. So where were we? What did you ask me?
The language of thought.
Yeah.
The language of thought, yeah.
The language of thought. Oh, all right. So one of the things that's wrong with the language of thought is it's like language. It uses duplication instead of identity to represent identity. All right, there's another thing about the language of thought that's very important, and that is, but it's interesting because it's not Jerry Voder. You know, the language of thought idea was developed by people like, Wilbur Sellers was probably primary here. And the thought there was that what made a belief, say, or about something, was the fact that it was connected by inferential dispositions to a lot of other things that the thing was itself connected to. So what made your thought of dog about dogs was that having thought of a dog, you think four legs, and then you think it barks, and then you know you have all of these inferences that you will make, given, and also input inferences, things, you know, ways that you will infer that something is a dog by knowing something else about it. So those inferential connections were what made the thought of dog about dogs. So it was the connection, the network, the connection of these ideas to one another that gave them their aboutness. So in Sellers, for instance, you find him saying explicitly that you can't have a thought of one thing without having a thought of a whole lot of things, right? All right, so that's the language of thought picture, although it's interesting because Jerry Fodor himself, of course, argued against holism. And I think his arguments were wonderful. He was absolutely right that this kind of holism really can't stand up. But anyway, that thought that somehow or other you find out you describe a concept by describing its inferential connections to other things. That is usually bound up with the language of thought view has been, and that I reject completely. Inferentialism, I reject completely.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So let me, we've been talking a lot, you know, sort of touching on the idea of, you know, language and once we get to that we kind of proceed to the second part of the book where you talk about info signs and intentional signs and that sort of a thing. So we kind of build from the UNICEPs to the what I saw as, you know, at least a more straightforward extension of your, you know, previous work in language thought and, you know, other biological categories where you're directly talking about, you know, intentions and language and things like that. So there's a number of different topics here, but maybe we should start about, you know, the concept of a info sign or a sign that carries natural information, intentional signs as a, you know, a particular type of info sign. And then also, you know, how are these sorts of signs related to the UNICEPs?
All right. So UNICEP is trying to collect information over time and perhaps from various perspectives about the same thing. It's trying to recognize the same thing through various different signs of them. You know, think of what's hitting the retina, what's hitting the eardrums as signs of the external world. All right. So this is something that I hadn't talked about at all in my previous work, and that is how do you think of these signs? What is the relation of these? What is the relation to what hits your eardrums to the thing that you recognize as a trumpet? You know, what is the relation here? So I begin then by trying to give a description of what I call info signs. Think of it roughly as what some people used to call natural signs. Black clouds mean rain. The rings on the tree show how old it is, so, et cetera. Those of trying to give a description of natural signs, or what I call them info signs, signs in the natural world that carry information, and trying to give a description of what it is for us there to be a sign that carries information in the natural world, right? All right, so that's the first project. Then the second project is to say how something like language, the signs of language, are related to that. And the rough claim is rather striking, maybe. What I want to claim is that signs like language signs, thought signs, etc., when they are working properly, when they are true, when they are correct, and when they got to be correct by in a normal way, you know, not just by accident. You could have accidentally have beliefs that are true, but when they got to be true in a normal way, that they actually carry information in the same way that black clouds may carry information about rain. So that basically understanding language has a surprising similarity to simply recognizing that it's a trumpet when you hear it. You know, so words actually are, I want to argue that words actually carry information when the sentences, you know, when they're in true sentences, and those true sentences were arrived at normally, in the way in which historically has accounted for the proliferation of the mechanisms that, that do this stuff, that in those cases that the language carries natural, the language is a natural sign of what it's about. So, all right, so that's the connection. So then the question is, all right, so what makes language different? And the answer is that language has been purposefully designed to carry information. By purposefully, I simply mean by natural selection, by learning, by you know, various analogs of natural selection, that the mechanisms that produce and understand language, or that produce and understand any intentional sign, are mechanisms that have been designed to do that. So it's not by accident. When you speak a true sentence to a friend, it's not by accident that it carries natural information, right? Language is designed to carry that natural information, and that's what makes it different from just ordinary natural information. It's, you know, it's designed natural information. Is that? Yeah. So we want to charge again, Carrie?
Yeah, no. So let me just, you know, speaking of conventional signs, and in this part of the book in particular, I was thinking of, you know, the pragmatic semantics, you know, and I noticed that you had a couple of references like to Robin Karsten or François Reconnetty and people. Can you say something about, you know, your view of meaning of these conventional signs? The, you know, one of the debates here is the extent to which the meaning of a linguistic item is, you know, lexically encoded or core or context independent. I mean, there's a number of different ways of referring to roughly the same phenomenon. And of course, the pragmatic semanticists say there's not very much that is lexically encoded, you might say, in the meaning. Where do you stand on that? And it, you know, it seems like you would be much more of a, you know, well, I mean, you just, you know, your description of uniceps, those being particulars, and it seems to lend itself to a fairly radical, you know, indeterminacy of meaning, and a very pragmatic semantic-y type view. So could you say something about, you know, less?
I think the symptoms you were seeing are not symptoms of the cause you're suggesting. Let me see if I can, one of the things I try to do, you know, people talk about this is the literal meaning, and then you have this compositionality, and then you get different meanings. One of the questions I want to ask is, all right, tell me, really, what constitutes that this is the literal meaning? And everybody sort of assumes, oh, well, you know, there's the literal meaning, right? And then there's compositionality, and then we churn out meanings of whole sentences. So my question is, what constitutes that this is the literal meaning? And my claim here is that if we can look at language in a very interesting way, you can look at language as actually having an evolutionary history in this sense. I mean, not that somehow or other the word dog is somehow or other a better word, a better sound than anything else to stand for dogs. But an evolutionary history in the sense that evolution is very interested in symbiosis and the way in which, say, different animals can actually develop traits that are coordinate such that they can work together on something. So what language is, of course, the development of coordination between speakers and hearers. But, all right, so my claim then is that you can look at, you can ask yourself, what is the function of a term in language? And what you can mean by that, interestingly, is what is it that accounts for it continuing to be used by speakers in roughly the same way and understood by hearers in roughly the same way? What is it that accounts for its proliferation? Or you can go back, thinking in Darwinian terms, what accounts for its survival? What accounts for its survival without changing its meaning, right? What is it doing that accounts for its survival? All right. So I take it that the very central question to be asked about any part of speech, any idiom, whatever, is what's its survival value? What's it doing? Now, what that gives you is a very different picture of language than perhaps as usual. You have to think then, you have to think in terms of what some linguists call constructions. A construction is not, two things are not the same construction because they sound alike or look alike. Two things are the same construction, often it's said because not only do they sound alike, but they have the same meaning. So if you have homonyms, they're different constructions. Well, my claim is that what really corresponds to a construction is, you can think of it as a lineage, is a string of reproduced cases. Dog, 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 reproduce, 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 reproduce. I'm going to ask, why does it continue to be reproduced? What's it doing? All right, so that was where you would look for literal meaning. Would be in let's look for a lineage. Let's look for something that's being reproduced and reproduced and reproduced and reproduced to do this particular job. But if you do that, then it's going to turn out not only that they're homonyms, but that there are also words and phrases that are related to each other, but that may, as a matter of fact, proliferate quite independently. And people who study language have recognized this, people learn a huge number of phrases of, people call them constructions, right? That are copied and copied and copied and copied. And that's what's learned rather than learning a lot of individual words and then putting them together every time you make a sentence. That's just not how it works psychologically. Big chunks are copied. And that means that big chunks can have a literal semantic meaning without taking them apart, without deriving that from the internal structure. Right. And it also means that there can be a lot more homonyms, as it were, in the language than you might think. That is, independent lineages that are proliferating the same sound with somewhat different uses. But I use it this way because other people used it that way. So what this does is to suggest that there are a lot more literal meanings than you would have thought. And that most, I think, a huge proportion, at least, of what has been taken to require pragmatics to explain is actually explained as a literal meaning. It's been reproduced and reproduced and reproduced to mean that.
So there's a couple of problems that you address in terms of having info signs relate to the things that they signify. And there's two in particular that you discuss at some length. One is the strength of correlation problem, and the other is the reference class problem. And I was just wondering if you could say a little bit about these two issues that arise. I take it that there's, even though there is a lot of you have these lineages and there's a lot more, sounds very polysemic in a way. There's still stability there, right? And so could you say something about both of those problems, the strength of correlation problem and then the reference class problem?
The discussion of the strength of correlation, the reference problem, was in an attempt to define infoscience. Infoscience, as you remember, are something prior to intentional science. So this, we're talking about something that's more fundamental than language here. That we were talking about language when language is functioning. When I say functioning properly, that is functioning in the way that has accounted for its survival and not in ways that, you know, not in ways that are not going to continue and be reproduced, but in ways that, you know. Okay. So so one project that is just defining natural science is one way of putting it, though I call them infoscience, science that carry information. And one classic way of doing that, and at least a modern classical way of doing that, is by saying that a sign is the relation between a sign and what it signifies is correlation. That there's a correlation between these two. So that, or put it this way, that when the sign occurs, there's a better chance of what it signified occurring than if the sign hadn't occurred. So there's a correlation between the sign and the probability of the signified, right? So, all right, so I kind of take off from that. And I say the problem here is people often simply talk about what's the probability of X having happened, you know? There's no such thing as a probability of something having happened without a reference class. Do 18-year-olds have more accidents than older people, right? 18-year-olds where? In what culture? At what time? You know, whenever you do statistics, you have a ring around a reference class. And it turns out that if you think very hard about this, you'll see that you have to, that the problem here is that you would have to say what reference class was involved in order to say, oh, it's a matter of correlations. So, what shall I say? This is not an easy issue, but roughly my conclusion here is that it turns out that being a natural sign of something really, it's like, what shall I say, being a sign for an animal, it's like being food. Whether or not something is food depends on the animal who wants to eat it, right? Similarly, whether or not something is going to count as information, as carrying information, is going to be relative to an animal. It's going to be relative to the capacities of that animal, relative to the place in which the animal is, lives, and moves, and then you have to take account of this. Anyway, that has a lot of interesting results that I can't go into here, but all right. So you can see that's part of how context then enters the matter here, right? Context is what reference class are we in? In that sense, it's very important. But you know, there's another way in which context is very important, and in which I think you may have in mind, Carrie. I'm not sure. What I've also claimed that in the case of language, very often pieces of the environment are actually part of a sentence. In other words, to think that language is only utterances is confusion. That as a matter of fact, utterances placed in juxtaposition with objects, the entire configuration is often what's the sign. And so this is why I give an analysis of indexicals, for instance, and of demonstratives, in which the thing demonstrated is actually a piece of the sign, like a sign that says, no lorries on a British bridge. Part of the sign is the bridge. You haven't the slightest idea what that means unless you see that it's on a bridge. So the bridge is part of the sign. It stands for itself. So actually the theme that the themes that there are things that in certain contexts can sort of stand for themselves is also a theme that weaves in and out of the book here and there with various effects.
But. Right. So that sounds a bit like, you know, the extended mind thesis, you know, Andy Clark and David Chalmers, I suppose. Are you endorsing that sort of a view?
No.
Well, what? Why not?
No, I mean, this would not. Well, I don't think that any mental signs are composed partly of things in the world. No, I think that's quite a different question. What shall I say? I think the question whether mind is partly external is unfortunately largely a verbal problem. Not, you know, I don't think that there's very much substance there, but I'd have to, you know, back that up. And I, yeah.
Let me, you also introduced this concept of a reproductively established families. I don't, you know, it plays an important role, and I don't know if you would want to go into that to flesh out what you've already said or.
All right, that was a term that was defined back in language thought and other biological categories. And I won't try to go through that here, but just the way it applies to language is fairly straightforward. And that is that what I was talking about lineages, the word dog being copied and copied and reproduced and reproduced and reproduced, and perhaps phrases being reproduced and reproduced and reproduced, they have lineages. Those families where one thing is reproduced from another, from another, from another, those are reproductively established families. So, you know, well, the broader definition, we don't need to play with here, I think, of reproductively established family. Mm-hmm.
What would you say are the main differences or advances or modifications that you introduce in this book, as opposed to, you know, the work that it has built on?
Maybe my own prior work or work of others. My own prior work, yeah. The explication of uniceps. I talk quite a lot about empirical concepts, right, starting with language thought and other biological categories and going through on clear and confused ideas. It's very a lot about this. What I was working toward in my mind, I guess, was the notion of a unicept, a unitracker, and you know, the combination of a unitracker with its unicept, or unicept with its unitracker. And so that a lot of the things that I said earlier about empirical concepts, I would now say that was a very bad terminology. And if you look at it as a discussion of unitrackers and unicepts, it'll make a little more sense, I think. So I'm definitely carrying that on, but also changing it. But I would say, having discovered, I guess, how very, very different in so many respects the notion of a unicept and a unitracker is from the classical notion of a concept. So, you know, so that's one thing that has changed. But also the whole business of talking about information theory in the last half of the book, and also spelling out something about spelling out the notion of the literal semantic meaning. And it's also some things at the end of the book. I mean, I talk about some specific problems people have had about language, talking about indexicals and demonstratives, for instance. I hadn't done that before. About intentional contexts, I have more to say. But also tackling problems like, what do you do with definite descriptions that aren't definite, right? The dog. Well, I saw the dog, right? So, you know, talking about some ways that language works, that you could look at language somewhat differently through these eyes and some of the results you get.
Okay. So, well, one of the things you do at the end is to draw certain parallels, to talk a little bit about perception, right? And perceptual content. Could you say something about, you know, the perceptual content and, you know, sign content?
Yeah, that's another huge issue, isn't it? Yeah. Actually, what I do is to try to back up a claim that I think most people have found quite bizarre, and that is that understanding language is actually a variety of something like perception. The processing and understanding language is like perceptual processing. So this requires looking at perception in rather a different way. So one thing that I do here with perception, I would like to understand perception, or try to argue that you can understand perception as interpretation of signs. You know, the classical view that what you do is just in visual perception is to try to reconstruct what could have caused the visual sensations, etc. You have to somehow or other reverse the process by which the object hits your eye. So I want to claim instead that no, it's like recognizing a sign. And recognizing the sign for something, I do not have to have the slightest idea how the sign got to be there, by what process the sign got to be there. If I could recognize the sign, I may not have the slightest idea why those signs are around. So recognizing a sign is very different from understanding anything about the process by which the sign was produced. It turns out that makes quite a lot of difference, I think, if you look at perception that way. There's some Gibsonian tinges here, but yeah.
So we are just about out of time, and I like to ask what's on the immediate horizon for you. Are you working on, maybe perception or perceptual content, or what's your next step at this point, philosophically?
All right, so I'm working on a couple of things that will be coming out. One of them is, I said that I wanted to understand the meaning of us. I wanted to understand linguistic meaning by trying to understand what accounts for the reproduction of words and syntactic structures, etc. You know, what are they doing that accounts for their reproduction? I have an essay now that I'm trying to, I never had looked at all of the things that language does besides representing. It has many other functions than representing. I'm working on an essay at the moment that is a more careful explanation, I hope, of what it means to say that you're looking for the actual function of a linguistic term. And then a number of tentative suggestions about puzzling words about how probability words about probable words about existence, identity. I don't know, there are a bunch of them that are sort of classic philosophical if-thens. You know, a number of classic questions that I think. A lot of light can be cast on by looking at function instead of by looking for truth conditions.
Okay. Well,
so anyway, that's one. But the other is that I'm also working a little on the current context, trying to make very much more simple and obvious the notion of representation and what makes a representation count as correct or incorrect. Trying to make this more straightforward, more obvious than perhaps I had before, because I think there's been some strange controversies about whether there are mental representations, right?
Right. Okay. Well, I'm sorry, but we are out of time. But I appreciate your taking the time to talk with us about your new book. It's been a real pleasure on my part.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Carrie, for giving me the opportunity to do this. Yeah.
You've been listening to my interview with Ruth Garrett Milligan. We've been talking about her new book, Beyond Concepts, Unicepts, Language, and Natural Information, which is just out from Oxford University Press. This is New Books in Philosophy. I'm Carrie Figdor. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.